Welcome everybody. We are beginning tonight a special mini-series in our open forms. Tonight is Monday night, March 14th, 2012. We are going to begin a very special itsy-bitsy little book. It is called in Hebrew a kontres, which may be, did I meant to say May? I always get confused. I'm one of these, March 14th, I said? Okay, May 14th, 2012. Sometimes, you know, gotta give yourself a little whack there. But anyway, sometimes in your head and your mouth don't match. Remember I've always said in many of my classes how there's no such thing as an accident or a coincidence. Everything happens for a reason and a purpose, not even a distraction. Aside from the host, I'm your host, Ariel Bar Tzedok, and you find me online at koshertorah.com, and it is May the 14th, not March. Why does a little thing like that happen? To teach us a lesson. Always pay attention. And that is one of the most important things that we're here to learn. This little kuntres, as we call it, it's like a little pamphlet. It's of 15 little sections, and it is entitled in Hebrew, Sha'ar HaKabbalah V'Sidra, the gateway to, we call it the Kabbalah, but it means the reception and its order. It's an old text, I would guess, written in the late 1200s, early 1300s. The reason why I'm guessing at this time is because the book is attributed to Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, the famous Nachmanides, Ramban, with the nun at the end. He passed away in the year 1270. Now, the interesting thing about this little pamphlet here is, while I don't believe Ramban himself actually wrote it, it's very possible one of his students did. But what is very clear from the language, the style, and the teachings, that this is clearly a pre-Zoharic text. When the Zohar exploded on the scene in Judaism, it completely changed the course of the religion, and especially what we call its mysticism. The Zohar and everything that comes out of it, which includes all later Kabbalah, of course the systems of the Ari and everybody after, is a system. For those of you who don't know me and koshertorah.com, I always prefer to go back to the most ancient and original systems of biblical Torah, including what, if we can use the term mysticism, it's not a term I like, but a term that I'm willing to use. This little pamphlet here that we're about to explore is in that earlier realm, at the beginning of a period where in which there's a interesting transition being made between what we can call the practical secrets of the Torah, because remember, mysticism is what we call the secrets of the Torah. That's a term I prefer. Practical, I mean experiential. Literally, meaning going into altered states of consciousness, interacting with other entities, and learning from them about spirituality directly. As far as I'm concerned, that is the only true Kabbalah. Everything else is just a superficial imitation. That's my opinion. Of course, I probably just ticked off a whole lot of people who are into what's called the philosophical path, but too bad. I mean, we all have our ways and things. But this little pamphlet in 15 sections is going to deal with the topic of what we call the Ten Sefirot. Now, the Ten Sefirot are what we call the divine emanations of God. How God goes from his unknowable essence to his knowable self in this body of existence, which we call reality. I don't even want to use the term like universe, because in light of modern day science, as in ancient secrets of Torah teachings, we've always known that there were multiple universes. The later Kabbalah, of course, refers to an innumerable, an infinite number of universes. And that is something I think that we should be willing to embrace. Now, this little pamphlet here is going to speak about these 10 Sefirot, but it's going to speak about them in a very not so much theoretical way as much as very much hinting to a practical way. I've got to explain what I mean by this. Now, historically speaking, what on earth is this concept of divine emanations? Well, if you speak to the later philosophical Kabbalists, they will say these concepts and ideas were revealed to Moses at Mount Sinai, were passed down orally in an unbroken chain to modern time. Well, that is what the Orthodox religion will proclaim. But those of us who are a little bit more, shall we say, involved in study, recognize and know that in the earliest literature, that which existed in biblical times, temple times, Mishnaic times, and very possibly even Gemara times, there was no such thing or concept of these 10 Sefirot. Now, many people might say, oh, they're reflected in the Ten Commandments. There's a reflection to them in ancient Midrash where it speaks that God created the world in 10 ma'amarot, 10 figures of speech. These are all references to it. And there are verses that they quote from the Bible which make references to the names of the Sefirot. But, of course, they took the names of the Sefirot from the verse. The verse, of course, came first. All of these are later ideas and claims. Is the concept of Sefirot ancient from Sinai? Perhaps. But of course, there's absolutely no evidence to validate it. And there is a tremendous amount of secrets of Torah literature that existed for 1,000 years without any reference to such concepts. The first reference to a concept of Sefirot we can date from maybe the 3rd or the 4th century, depending on your scholarship's point of view. And this is around the Talmudic time. And the book that references them first is called the Sefer Yetzirah. I have taught the Sefer Yetzirah from its practical, experiential, meditative perspective from the ancient sources. And it's available as a course on koshertorah.com. But the references in the first chapter to that book about the 10 Sefirot, as they are going to be reflected in our work here, very curious is that the way the Sefirot are described in the Sefer Yetzirah are almost, and some suggest, in contradiction to how they are understood in later literature. Now that is a very interesting transition, because the Sefer Yetzirah speaks of 10 Sefirot, and that's it. It never gives these Sefirot names. It never applies to them any attributes. It just says that they are there. And in my entire first chapter's commentary, which took us, oh gosh, over a dozen lessons, I believe, I taught meditative techniques specifically to encourage people to cultivate a direct personal experience with Sefirot rather than to contemplate them philosophically, metaphysically, as they are explained in literature. You can learn all about a thing and not know a thing. And that is something which is a vital piece of information. I will give you a very blunt and direct example, which I'm sure you will all be able to understand. A person can go to school, college. Get a bachelor's, master's, and even PhD level education in the topic of sexuality. And they can learn all about sex. They can look at every movie made and read every book written and know every study and have interviews and the like. But if they are yet a virgin who has never had the experience, what do they really know? They know a lot of theory, but they know no practice. And therefore, all of their information and accumulated knowledge is built on a weak, if not baseless, foundation. When it comes to experiencing spiritual reality, it is the same. You can read what all the books say, and you can learn what all the opinions say, and that's all well and good. But unless you go there and see for yourself and know, then ultimately in the end, you end up knowing nothing. This little book of ours is one of the interesting transitions which takes us from the practice and begins to explain things to us about these sephirot in a way in which the Sefer Yetzirah never did. And I might add, apparently from the time that this book was penned and possibly written, it must have been pre-Zoharic, because the teachings of the Zohar really do not reflect that much in it. Now, it doesn't mean that there are no correlations or similarities. Of course there are. But that doesn't mean, or we cannot see in any way, how this book took from the Zohar. Not saying that the Zohar took from here, but rather, similarities, yes. Connection, well, I'll let some other scholar come and prove something that, in my opinion, just does not exist. With that introduction, I'm now going to read to you the original Hebrew text, and needless to say, we're going to stop, and we're going to comment, and we're going to learn, and I pray that God will bless me, that I'm going to try my best to make this practical and relevant for you, simply because I'm not interested in you sitting there taking notes. I'm not interested in you having another course under your belt like a feather in your cap. I don't want you to just have more interesting topics of information. I want you to contemplate these things. I want you to feel them within you. I want you to experience them for yourself. Because let me tell you this, there is that which is above mind, which is above thought. You cannot think about it. You cannot know it. But just because you can't think about a thing, just because you cannot know a thing, does not mean that you cannot experience a thing. We experience things all the time that we do not know, and that we cannot, if you will, put our finger on. So be it. That doesn't mean that you are any less connected. Now, to begin the work. Sha'ar HaKabbalah B'Sidra. It says here in the beginning, Yitbarach Shem HaBore, Shehu Hai V'Kayem La'ad De'ad. Blessed be the name of our Creator, who lives forever and ever. V'hu berachamav ye'ir einai b'torato v'yachshicheni meshigiyot. Then may He in His mercy open my eyes in His Torah and protect me from making any mistakes in these teachings. Aleph, section 1. Reshit kol davar. Let's begin in the beginning, the very beginning. Notice that the Torah itself begins with the word Bereshit, in the beginning. So it is no coincidence that he writes here Reshit with the intent of, again, telling us, let's go right back to the source of all things. You might think that this is just a simple statement, but simplicity has multiple levels within it. And to get to the ultimate simplicity takes us to a realm, like I said, that can only be experienced but can never be known. The beginning of all. Shehu, he is Reshit Lekol V'Kadmon Lekol, referring to God as He. He is the beginning of all and the most ancient of all. But a point that's made very clearly in the commentary here, as well as something we must always understand. Whether we refer to the Bible, whether we refer to any Judaic literature, we refer to God in the male tense. This is called in Hebrew a kinui. A kinui, modern translation, would be a nickname. Better referred to as a metaphor. The Creator is not male. The Creator is not female. You could say, well, the Creator is both. Well, isn't that what it said? Man was created in God's image, male and female. We make a general mistake, which is actually promoted in the Bible itself, and it's done for the sake of enabling the limited and frail mortal human mind to have any semblance of understanding. And that is, we tend to personify God, anthropomorphize God as some type of a super human being. Even though we will acknowledge that it is a mythology to think that God's a little old man with a white beard sitting on a cloud somewhere, a la the painting in the Sistine Chapel, right? We all know that's not true, but nonetheless, that is how we think. The sages throughout the centuries, and especially the rabbis of today, try to make God look like a, you know, a merry old grandfather. And this, of course, is not only a myth, but for those who believe it and embrace it, it can actually violate the biblical law of idolatry. To think of God as a male, to think of God as a king, these are all metaphorical terms to help the limited mind understand a concept of relationship. But the Creator of the universe is far more than anything of that kind. It is far more than anything human. It says here, it is the beginning of all and the most ancient of all. And the next words, which are ultimately essential, Vehu ne'elam mekol. And I'm not going to refer to God anymore as He, but it is concealed from all. And what that all is, we'll get to in just a minute. Concealment. What we call God, in my experience, I have come to call the collective consciousness and reality of existence. This is what we must understand. When we are referring to the ultimate source, we are talking about something beyond all parallel dimensions and worlds, beyond all higher dimensions of any kind of elevated being. We are even referring to a reality beyond the manifestation of the Creator itself in creation. This is a level, it's referred to in the later Kabbalah as the Ein Sof, but the original doesn't use that term, so neither will I, other than as an explanation. But you must understand the nature of this concealment. We all want to have a vision of God. We all want to have an experience of God. We all have an illusion, a fantasy, that when we die, we go to heaven and there's God with us. ain't that nice. He, it, is concealed from all. Continuing in the text.
Behu nikra ilat ha'ilot. It, at this level, is called the cause of causes.
Somebody's here asking a question, are all or most angels male? Why would you think an angel is male in the first place?
Now, continuing. The cause of all causes. This is a concept because we speak of causes, but yet there's a cause beyond the cause. It's an interesting question because when you speak to an atheist, one who doesn't want to believe in the existence of a supreme being, one of the argumentative questions they ask is, well, if God exists, where did he come from? Somehow, somewhere, something must have created it. The answer to that is, they're right. And then I might add, well, if God was created by some higher, then where did that higher come from? And where did that come from? And where did that? Let's go back 10 steps. Ultimately, we get to the point, there is no question. There is no answer. There is no knowing. But there can be an experience which transcends knowledge. Unknown, concealed, beyond any kind of thought, not only your thought and mine in limited mortal human form, but even beyond. Even in the great world to come and the great beyond, when we will shed these mortal coils of flesh and become bodies of luminescent light, when we ourselves will become stars and we ourselves will become expanded in consciousness from one end of our universe to another, there will still be that above us which is concealed. And even then, we will not see that which is unseen. It says here, Ein lomar alav, lo yesh, lo ein. At this level of God's ultimate singularity and simplicity, there is nothing to be said. We cannot apply the concept of what is. We cannot apply the concept of what is not. In an earlier piece of literature that I wrote, I think almost 20 years ago, I referred to God as the great is not. And anything that we could say about God that is by definition not, because God is not. Do you understand what I am saying? God is by being is not. I cannot say anything. No one can say anything about the essence, the foundation, the source, because it is above and beyond everything. It is above God's name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. It is above God's name Elohim. It is above everything. It is above every name. There is no name to be applied. There is nothing to be known. There is nothing to be unknown. There is nothing. So ultimately, it's not even nothing. Can't even say it's nothing. It's a concept, a reality, an experience that by definition is contradictory within the context of our concepts of reality. Our reality understands the existence and non-existence. The ultimate source is both. How can you understand that? You can't. Don't try. Accept. And then ultimately you cultivate experience. And out of that experience, a spark, like that proverbial light bulb, will pop over your head, which will give you some semblance of understanding. It continues the text that says, "Ki hu nistar af min ha-malachim." God is concealed even from the angels. Now, when you go back into the earliest of what we call mystical literature, the writings of the Merkava ascenders, really called the descenders, you will find numerous books written about how certain individuals and their meditative practices, which is what we try to teach here, had the ability to ascend to various levels of what we call the heavens. We find references to the seventh heaven. Even in the Christian tradition, there's a reference to Saul of Tarsus, who later became called Paul, supposedly going up to the third heaven. Unfortunately, Christians who read this material never knew that there are other levels beyond. So we find many people went through up to the seventh heaven. But the seventh heaven was called the doorway to the Holy of Holies. And only special ones went and penetrated into the Holy of Holies, into what became known later as the eighth, ninth, and tenth levels of heaven. And this is called the concealed of concealments. Those who have achieved such levels are few. They are experiential, psychic projections, vision quests, astral projections, call it whatever you'd like. But many of those who we call the angelic hosts, the likes of Michael, Gabriel, Uriel, Raphael, Metatron, not even they go in at that level. So he says, not only did the angels conceal, call the Homer, all the more so those of us who dwell in these houses of physical flesh. Alav ne'emar, with regards to this understanding and level of God, they apply the saying, b'mufla mimcha al tachkor. It's actually a reference from the Gemara, the Tractate Haggigah 13a, that which is beyond you, do not seek to investigate. Why? And this is where the big philosophical Kabbalists make terrible errors. They try to go in and explain the unexplainable, and they write chapters and chapters and books about the Ein Sof and the levels within the Ein Sof and the upper worlds and everything else, and this is like this and this is like that. Granted, there are those who have had visionary experience of these and have written their perceptions down. For example, Rabbi Chaim Vital, or for example, Yisrael Saruk. But those who came after them, and they were of course in the 1600s, and they're the ones who codified what we call today the Kabbalah of the Arizal. But those who came after them were philosophers. They did not have meditative experience, and therefore they wrote books upon books upon books, none of which are a reflection other than the thoughts of their authors. There's still great material to learn for profound philosophical insights, but they are not guides to experience. They offer suggestions of an answer, which may or may not be the right answer, especially if and when you don't even know the right question. Vayadanu ki hakol kalul talui bo. Everything is included and dependent within it. Now, this has always been one of the foundational teachings that I have always taught. There's an ancient legend that says, in the beginning, God gazed into his Torah and from it created the world. Meaning that the Torah must have predated existence, and that is what we believe. We'll get to what the Torah is as we proceed. It was not there in the concealment. Obviously, it came out of the concealment. We know that God and His Torah are a reflection of one another, kind of like the hand that extends forth from the body. If I stretch out my hand is acting as an expression of what? Not just the electric charges in my brain, which is sending through my nerves the movement in my hand, but rather the will and purpose for which I extend my hand forth. My hand is not acting mechanically. It is following, not my brain, my mind. My hand will extend in accordance to the will of my mind, which projects itself through the chemical and electrical working of my brain and the nerves of my body, which then extends to my hand. Understand it like that. Everything came forth out of the source. And thus I say, if the Torah is the source of all the universe, then all the universe exists inside the Torah. Which means that wherever we go in the universe, we should be able to be studying the Torah with or without a book. So let's just say that, I am successfully able to finish the flying saucer that I'm building in my garage right now. And I'm able to put it in my hyperlight drive and my time control portals and times and relative dimensions in space, TARDIS a la Doctor Who. And I have this big machine and I can go anywhere in time and in space. So zoom, off I go. I'm now 14 billion light years off and the other side of 5 trillion different dimensions away, a trillion billion years in the past, present, whatever. I'm as far away as I can get. Guess what? Wherever I end up, no matter how weird existence is there, I can still learn Torah. Because wherever I end up, Torah is there as much as Torah is here. Now, I don't know if you can hear it in the background, but I'm sitting in my office right now, and our big doggy is barking outside. I don't know if you can hear him. All right, I can hear that in the background. I don't know if you can. The Torah is to be found in the bark of the dog. When I make a mistake about just the slip of the tongue, March instead of May, we learn Torah from that. Like I say to you, the Torah is in everything, everywhere. And it's because you don't see that. You create divisions and limitations in your own mind, separating between where God is, where God isn't. What God wants, what God doesn't want. There's an old song that they used to sing to the children. God is here and God is there. Oh, God is truly everywhere. Up, up, down, down, all around. They used to sing that to the kids and they're 3. Nice words, but we forget it. We don't experience it. When you're sitting in traffic in your big, disgusting urban cities, and the horns are honking and it's stinking and everybody's yelling and screaming, do you know that God is there? No, no. You have to go into quiet. You have to go into peace. You have to go off here and off there. No! Melo kol ha'aretz kavodo. The world is full of His glory. We'll get to a definition of glory as we go. Everywhere. In everything. Real meditation isn't some mechanical silencing of the mind. It is the expansion of the mind. Easier to do through the quiet, and then ultimately to embrace the noise. And ultimately you come to recognize that the noise, the distractions, are only the surface. And that underneath it is the depths of the sea. And you are upon the sea. And no matter what you look at, no matter what you see, you will only know the One. That is what you must experience. Talk is cheap. That which is above us, you will not comprehend. You can experience, but you won't comprehend. That's why it says that that which is above you, al-tahkur. Al-tahkur means to investigate. You can't investigate that which you can't. But it's there. The etzlo lo nitchadesh davar. Ach, etzle lo nitchadesh. From the side of the singularity, of the simplicity of it, everything is all the same. It always has been the same. Always will be the same. It's what Chaim Vital in the later theoretical Kabbalah called the Ur Pashut. Simplicity. It is a simplicity inclusive of all of which we cannot understand. Everybody refers in the later Kabbalah to God as the Ur Pashut, the simple light. And when you think about that, everybody thinks of this big white light. But no! Why would it be white? If anything, it's black. Pure blackness. Pure concealment. Pure darkness. Because remember, from his point of view, its point of view, nothing is renewed. Only from our point of view. If we look to our experience as we do, all we experience is the ultimate darkness, the ultimate simplicity, wherein which everything is absorbed. Light, darkness, good, evil, right, wrong, up, down, none of it exists yet. The ein bo lo shinui hafetz velo shinui ma'aseh v'ratzon. At this level, there is no change, no concept of desire or any change in action or will. There is nothing. This is the ultimate simplicity. That is the ultimate experience. Many people, when they ascend in meditative practice, will get to a level where they silence the mind and they will be in a state of nebulousness. It's called the cloud. Many people, when they go into meditation, get there. They say, oh, my mind is blank. Well, that's not this darkness. That's the cloud. That's what we call one of the three levels of the external kalipot, which must be transcended. The true path of recognizing and knowing is all in all. Meditation is a 24/7 experience. We should be in a state of meditation at this moment. What is meditation? Being bonded. As it says, I place God before me always. And to hear God's voice in the mistake of my own lips or in the bark of a dog. There's no such thing as a distraction. There is only what is. Why are things the way they are? I don't know. They just are. Now you can choose to try to fix them, change them, correct them, or you can just go with the flow. And when you do, you will find that the flow of the river emanates from the tree of life and will take you home. Not fighting, but surrendering. But tell Ritzonecha lifnei Ritzono, we are warned wisely in the Pirkei Avot. Nullify your will before its will. A surrender before heaven. Now, it says here, as according to the commentaries, a little change in the wording here, but I'll read it in both ways. The Karulo HaPhilosophim says here in the philosophers. Well, who are the philosophers? Well, they ain't the Jewish philosophers, they're the Greek philosophers. Because the concepts of levels of divine emanation, you will find more so spoken of and referenced in the writings of Pythagoras, Socrates, and Plato, more than you will find in Judaic literature of the time. The philosophers say, this is a level which thought the mind cannot grasp. And then it continues and says, there are those who call it, here's a very interesting term, Sechil HaFo'al, the active mind. Kiakol Memeno, because everything's from him. Now, according to the commentary, these words need to be reversed, where in which it says here, there are those who say that this is a level that thought cannot grasp, and it's the philosophers who call it the Sechel HaPo'al, the experience, the mind, the functioning of the mind of Fo'al, the functioning active mind. Now, Sechel HaFo'al is a very, very important concept. You will find this in all of the original mystical writings pre-Zoharic. And you will find even in Maimonides, there's a reference to what are called the spheres. Spiritual, that which we call spiritual, always called sechelim, nivdalim. Nivdalim means separate. Separate intelligences, separate thought. Okay? The sephirot are called levels of mind or consciousness. That's how you must understand them. This gets back to what the Sefer Yetzirah was teaching, which I enumerated in that course, about the sephirot being what's called belima, without substance, without form, without essence, beyond knowledge, but only experienced. So, the Sechel HaPo'al, some refer this to the highest level, some refer this to the lower level. In other words, using the names of the spheres, some say this is Keter, some say this is Malchut. And there's all kinds of dialogue as to which is which. But I will share with you this. They're one and the same. We have come to see the diagram of the ten sephirot, these levels of divine manifestation, in the form of what is called the tree of life. Later language, it's called Yosher, the columns. You have Keter, Hochma, Bina, right, you know, center, right, left, and the seven lower. Fine. The real form of the sephirot, Chaim Vital speaks about this, are called igulim, which are spheres. And one sphere transcends and permeates and interacts with another, so that the highest and the lowest actually merge into one another. You say, how is that possible? How can we understand that? Shut up. We're talking about realities in a dimensional existence which are contradictory to our present laws of physics. Deal with it. Active mind. God is called active mind. The function and projection of the unknown and the unknowable. Let me repeat. The function and performance of the unknown is the active mind, the Sechel HaPo'al. It's actually a Greek thought. Pretty smart, those Greeks, eh? That's the way they got it all from. Understand now, when we talk about God, that's ultimately what we're talking about. Not a little old man with a white beard, not a guy who gets angry and is going to punish us, because a point that is made in old Midrash, like Pirkei the Rabbi Eliezer, and is actually explained in eloquent detail by Rabbi Chaim Vital in his book, The Gates of Holiness, in Section 3, Chapter 1, of course, which we have full class online, which I'm offering half price now for anybody who wants it, hint, hint, hint. We refer to the unknowable God and the knowable God. The unknowable God is not called the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei or Elohim or anything. Remember, there's no name. But God which is known, that is referred to as God's name. And that is the secret of the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, Havayah is what we call it, comes from the root Hebrew verb He-Vav-He, which means Hove, which is to be. Anybody who knows Hebrew grammar knows. Why don't you take a passive verb and you put the letter Yud in front of the base prefix, you put the prefix Yud in front of the base verb. You're taking the verb and changing it from the passive to the active tense. So God's name, Yud, Hove, actually means being, Hove, in action, active being. The being of the unknown is not active. And once it becomes active, that's only an expression of the concealment, but not the actual concealment. Like my hand, which goes forth at my will to fulfill my purpose. But my purpose is not the actual activity of my hand. I go out in my hand to give you something. But the purpose is in my mind, and my mind is still concealed. This is why, for those of you who know traditional Jewish prayer, when we recite the name of God in a blessing, Baruch Atah Hashem, we always recite, Baruch Hu Uvaruch Shemo. Blessed be He, blessed be His name. That is a little meditation wherein which we're supposed to take God the known, merged with God the unknown. You can say, well, what's the purpose of that? The purpose is that we should never think that God's function in being is anything other than an expression of the ultimate source and will. And anyone who doesn't get that is making a division in God, driving a wedge in God's unity, thereby violating the fundamental message of Torah, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God. The Lord is one. This is the ultimate secret here. The ultimate, simple, ur pashut, unity. Everything that comes forth, which we're now about to learn, the Sefirot, are the revelations that this unknown, for whatever reason, makes known. And yet, everything that is already exists. Everything that is, everything that will be, everything that was, has already come and gone. From a point of view, the Messiah has already come. The Messiah is already gone. From a point of view, the universe has been created and the universe has been destroyed. We exist in a bubble of an illusion of the moment to think that our existence has any substance beyond a superficial illusion. And therefore, everything in this world is just that. We are as if prisoners within the physical flesh. We are as if a number in the village without ability to escape. Now you might say, well, we could always, you know, kill ourselves. Yeah, but where do you think you escape to when you go to another world? You just go into another world. Because even that which we call the world to come, it's a higher level, but still an illusion. Now here I'll reveal to you a wee bit secret about the world to come. We all die. God bless, we go to heaven. What's heaven like? Ask a Muslim. Ask a Catholic. Ask a Protestant. Ask a Mormon. Ask a Buddhist. Ask a Hindu. Ask an Orthodox Jew. Ask a Lubavitcher. Ask a Breslover. Of course, everybody has their own opinion. What is heaven really like? Do we all get to heaven and find out? All the false religions of the world, they're all false, and only Judaism is true. So when the Catholic priest who devoted his entire life to his church dies, he goes up and he's told by God, you know, all your life you lived a lie. Too bad. Gee, that would really be heaven, wouldn't it? Forget about the crazy bombers. You do have righteous Muslims out there who truly devote their lives to God without having to become radical, violent murderers. You have others from all different walks of life who live their lives in full devotion to heaven. What do you think heaven is like for them? You will find in books like Avkat Rochel references to what is called the lower Garden of Eden, symbolic to the lower level of heaven, where in which what you experience or expect heaven to be is exactly what you will perceive it to be when you get to the other side. So all jokes aside, Jews go to Jewish heaven, Christians go to Christian heaven, Muslims go to Muslim heaven. And you can say, well, gee, what happens then? Well, then there's higher levels, higher development, higher movement, till ultimately we get back to the singularity. That's a long way down the line. So understand and know, this is why we don't fight with people. This is why we don't challenge people. Yet, we let people live by righteousness. And that is what it is. So, somebody's asking here, do Muslims go to Muslim heaven for killing? I don't know. That's an interesting question. Prior to our beginning our class, as you know is my tradition, I always play some music. And I always tell you to pay attention to the songs that I put on. Because in them I am hinting to you many things. I put on a medley of 60s rock and roll songs. And I concluded with this song by the Moody Blues called Nights in White Satin. Never reaching the end. And other words in the lyrics said, what you want to be, you will be in the end. So I don't know about where Muslims go when they kill people and things like that. Something tells me that they probably do not go to a good end. But I will tell you, that which we create in our minds are the prisons in which we imprison ourselves. Every one of them is what we call a klipa. Every one of them is what we can call idolatry. So whatever you think is, it ain't. And therefore you have to learn to let go. Because the Sefirot are belima, without form, without substance. When we talked about thought, we'll now go into section 2 and begin this now before we conclude our class tonight. Hu Allah b'machshava lahamtzi ulatzil eses sfirot teluyot abalima. It, remember I don't like calling God he, it decided in its thought to bring forth and to emanate 10 sefirot, which it says here teluyot abalima. Again, a reference to the original language from the Sefer Yetzirah. They're built upon the words balima means without what? Without what? I put a question mark there. Without what? Without essence, without form, without structure. A lot of people want to go and get very philosophical and blah, blah, blah around, but when you experience a sefirah, you will just get a premonition, a feeling. You won't be able to put anything in words. You'll feel maybe a lightness, or a heaviness, or an inspiration, or a passion, or a settling. They are experiences beyond words. It says here that Lashon Sefirot, the language of the word Sefirot, Me Lashon Ur Tzach Ubahir. It actually comes from what's called a pure and brilliant light. Me Lashon Sapir Gezartam. From the word Sapir, which means like a sapphire. A sapphire. Now remember, we find referenced in the Torah that God's throne is considered to be like a sapphire. And all the philosophers want to get philosophical. Oh, this means this and this means that. Let me tell you something. I'm going to tell you exactly what it means. The sapphire is blue. Blue is the color of energy, life force energy. The ultimate light of day one of creation, sealed for the righteous. The original source is the emanation of, call it light, but better to call it an energy. It's the energy of life, the energy of sentience, the energy of consciousness. It's all kind of like one and the same. And the only thing I can tell you about it is that it's blue. And when you experience it, you'll know. When you look at the earth from outer space, you'll see it's surrounded with this little ribbon of blue. That's the life force of the earth. Call it, if you will, chi, nefesh. Call it whatever language. It's irrelevant. That is the essence. So when we talk about sefirot, they are, and at the same time, they are not. So he says here, perush belima, and what does it mean, belima? Belimu uma, without anything. There's no structure, there's no form. What form is energy? Is it a square? Is it a circle? We use metaphors of that nature to describe things. But that's not what they are. That's only our limited, imprisoned mortal minds, which can only understand within the limitations of our present prisons. Hu alai ilot shehi afisa muhletet. The ultimate essence, we said, the source of source, it is a complete nothingness. It's nothing that we can describe. Ma'afisa muhletet. Absolute, from the word ephes, zero. Now, in math today, we can count positive and negative numbers. I can go 0, 1, 2, 3, or 0, negative 1, negative 2, negative 3. But rather than going up and down, how about if I went sideways? Where would I go? What would I get? What would I have? Think about it. Might not come up with an answer. Why? Shelo yuchol adat lasig bo mu'uma. There is no knowledge that is able to grasp it at all. Not the knowledge of angels, not the knowledge of human beings. With regards to the angels, even they cry out and say, I am in kom kivado la'aritzo. Where is the place of his glory? Even the angels in heaven do not see God. Maybe they just see a pillar of fire which somehow telepathically impresses within them whatever their message and purpose and guidance and structure is supposed to be. Indeed, at Mount Sinai, that is how the Ten Commandments were, as if to say, written upon our hearts. They were telepathically projected into our minds with an energy force which fundamentally restructured or imprinted DNA. That is why to this day I very say, who stood at Mount Sinai? Who are the true children of Israel? Anyone who responds to this message, not by what theologically or philosophical message they embrace, but rather how they live. If they live in the reflection of this truth by that which we call righteous behavior, they were there. It's ingrained in their genes. We have found through modern DNA studies people far and wide who are of the bloodline. The most darkest of black Africans have been shown to have the gene of the holy line of Aharon, the priesthood. You find that same bloodline in people as far away as from Afghanistan, Native Americans in North America, some say even people from China, Japan, all around the world. God knows his own. There are those who want to refer to this here, Yesh Mifarashim. There are those who interpret the concept Balima, this without knowledge, as this, a quote from the Safiyat Sirah, on which note we will conclude, an appropriate place to conclude. Balum Pecha Melidaber, Belipecha Melehaher. Silence your mouth from speech. Calm your heart from thought. Because ultimately, the more you want to run forward to try to grasp, you are in essence trying to restrict, limit, trying to take the essence of the ocean and squeeze it into the little cup of your mind. It ain't gonna work. Sefi Tzerah, I teach people about the silence. In this year 2012, since January, my weekly emails I've been sending out in a somewhat poetic form. Rather than spelling out teachings to people who literally just don't get it, I write in poetic hint and subtleties, because that was the method of how instruction was thousands of years ago. I've gone back and I used that same structure. I release pieces. And I tell people, feel what I'm trying to say. Don't think about it. Read it as a poem, not as a prose. Some people can't handle it. They object, oh, Rabbi, why don't you just say what you mean? It's not a matter of saying what I mean. It's a matter of you being able to experience and knowing for yourself. Understand and know. I have a question here in text. Isn't Jewishness only passed through maternally? That's Jewishness. I'm not talking about who was a Jew. I'm talking who has Torah. You think that they're one and the same now, don't you? Good for you. On that note, let me conclude and say to you now, clear your mind of questions. Clear your mouths. Clear your hearts. Shh. Noise and silence are the same. Movement and stillness are the same. There is only the one singularity. Don't think about it. Feel it. And when you can, go beyond the feeling to the experience. God be willing, we'll pick up in our next class. Thank you all for joining me. God be willing, a copy of this recording will be available online at Future Lessons 2 for a relatively affordable purchase price. Thank you all for joining me. Again, I'm your host, Ariel Bart-Sadok. Find me online, koshator.com. See you all next time. God bless. Shalom.